Chapter 25, containing the story of the venerable chief and an account of Greencoat's injury. "Here I am," said Greencoat, stumbling out of the darkness. "I hope you've had a nice meal. If mine is cold, it doesn't matter in the least."
"I sounded the horn 4 times, said Big Tiger, "and I shouted, 'Dinner, dinner,' very loud," said Christian.
"Sit down," said Good Fortune affably. "We've got a grand fire, and congratulations on unexpected riches. Did you find many silver pieces?"
"I didn't look for any," replied Greencoat with dignity, "so I didn't find any. I was only taking a bit of exercise, that's all."
"Help yourself," said Good Fortune. "You must be hungry."
"The rice is burned," remarked Greencoat, laying his chopsticks aside.
"I'll never get over that," lamented Big Tiger. "It's my fault. I let the fire get too hot. Please restrain your rightful anger."
"Of course," said Greencoat, making an effort to smile indulgently.
"Come, men," said Good Fortune. "We must fix our camp for the night." He stood up and went with Christian and Big Tiger toward the poplar trees. Two of them lay half buried in the sand, their split branches stretched upward. They pulled the dead branches free of the sand and dragged them to their campfire. Then Good Fortune set to work to make nice fire logs of the thick branches, while Big Tiger sawed off the forks. When they had a fine heap of firewood, Good Fortune set it alight.
"Do you want to roast an ox?" asked Greencoat. "Or do you want to light robbers the way to us?"
"We needn't be afraid of robbers," said Big Tiger daringly. "Our respected elder has a pistol with lots of cartridges, so nothing can happen to us."
Greencoat made a contemptuous grimace and said he knew that, but just when they were most wanted, pistols didn't go off.
"You're wrong there," replied Good Fortune sharply. "Even an unloaded weapon can go off," and he gripped the holster. Big Tiger became terrified and hung on to Good Fortune's arm. "Don't shoot," he cried. "Please don't shoot. I can't bear shooting."
"I can't either," cried Christian, and he hung on to Good Fortune at the other side.
"Come, come," said Good Fortune, pacified. "I didn't know you were so scary."
"We have very delicate nerves," said Big Tiger.
"Pooh," said Greencoat, standing up. "No one could stand this heat. Why do you burn a whole heap of wood for nothing?"
"For your comfort," replied Good Fortune, sitting down at a little distance and watching the rustling flames shooting up into the night. When the fire had died down, he fetched a shovel and spread out the glowing embers. Then he threw sand over them and flattened it out. Suddenly they were in darkness. The moon was a beautiful crescent, poised coldly over the silent sea of sand, silvering the sharp edges of the rocks of Durban Mott.
"The Kong is heated," cried Good Fortune. "May you sleep well."
"Am I to lie in the sand and be eaten by fleas?" asked Greencoat insolently.
"I don't care what you do," Good Fortune answered, and he took his coat, lay down on the warm sand, and covered himself up. "Come," he invited Christian and Big Tiger, "fetch your sleeping bags and lie down. We won't freeze tonight."
"This is a great idea," said Christian, as he lay down beside Good Fortune and felt the warmth under him. "We'll sleep like Prince Chow."
"What about him?" asked Good Fortune.
"Just that," replied Big Tiger. "It's a poem we learned at school, and Kwee-chan knows it too, because I recited it to him."
"Say the poem to me," said Good Fortune. "I'd like to learn it too."
Then Big Tiger recited the poem of Prince Chow, who slept under a plum tree, and Good Fortune said he liked it, and that Big Tiger should say it again tomorrow, and the day after, and every day, until he knew it too.
"Nonsense," said Greencoat rudely. He had come, after all, and lain down beside Good Fortune on the warm sand. "Poems," he went on, "don't serve any useful purpose. What's the sense of saying, 'The rain is falling,' or 'The little wintry snowflakes flutter down'? We know already that it rains and that it snows."
"A poem rhymes," Christian objected, "and that's what makes it beautiful."
"And it can be sung," said Good Fortune. "That's what matters."
"When a poem is written," said Big Tiger, "you can look at it, and it's like a picture, and often more beautiful."
"Oh, rubbish," growled Greencoat. "Tell me instead where we're going tomorrow."
"That depends on the sea of sand," said Good Fortune. "A man never knows how far it goes, or where there's a way through. Perhaps we shall get to Abdur. Perhaps we shall reach Yingin Osu. Or perhaps we shall get only as far as the lonely tree, or perhaps get stuck somewhere.
and never get any place.
You've got a lot of perhapses in your stock, muttered Greencoat, and he turned over and began to snore.
Abder, whispered Christian. Is that the Box Mountain?
Hush, said Good Fortune. Don't speak to me of the Box Mountain. It's a dangerous mountain, and not far from here.
I know that, said Christian. Shall we see it?
We're driving by quite near it if...
If the spokes don't fall from the wheels, said Big Tiger dryly.
Hush, warned Good Fortune. I'm not superstitious, but you never can tell. Good night.
We wish you rest and comfort, said Christian and Big Tiger. And then there was silence. Night fell over the silent desert. So great was the vast loneliness that if Christian and Big Tiger had not been so tired, they would have been frightened. Not a night bird called, and not a wolf prowled. It was lonelier than on Robinson Crusoe's island. For a while, Good Fortune tossed about, torn with ugly thoughts of vengeance. But then he said, "It can't be helped," turned over, and fell asleep. He slept soundly until the cold breath of morning awoke him. Then he got up, gave the morning star a friendly nod, and set to work to get the fire going. He fetched water, and just as the flames shot up and the tea began to boil, and he was about to call out, "Get up, men, the night is over," he saw by the firelight a small gray snake, peacefully coiled up on Greencoat's thigh. When Greencoat stirred a little in his sleep, it raised its head, waved it to and fro, and hissed.
"That's fine," thought Good Fortune vengefully. But then he noticed that Big Tiger lay beside Greencoat, and that at any sudden movement, he might just as easily be bitten.
There was no time to lose, as either of the sleepers might awake at any moment. Good Fortune went hot and cold with perplexity, and was actually thinking of trying to shoot the reptile when a brilliant idea occurred to him. He dashed to the truck and got the whip. Then he crept noiselessly, step by step, up to Greencoat, until at last he stood beside him. The little gray snake was lying there quietly. He gripped the bamboo handle wrong way round in both hands, drew a deep breath, raised the whip, aimed, and then, not without some pleasure, delivered a fearful blow. The snake's head was smashed and its spine broken in several places. Greencoat awoke with a frightful roar. Christian sat up with a start, and Big Tiger slid hurriedly out of his sleeping bag.
"Help! Murder!" yelled Greencoat, trying to stand up, but falling back again with a groan.
"Has any sudden damage occurred?" asked Big Tiger soberly.
"He's smashing my bones!" yelled Greencoat.
"I've saved his life," said Good Fortune, lifting the dead snake on the whip and throwing it in front of Greencoat's nose. "There," he said, "the second half of your life hung on a thread."
"A sand viper," cried Christian. "Anyone bitten by it dies instantly," declared Big Tiger.
"There was no way out," declared Good Fortune. "A good hard blow had to be given with the best intentions." But Greencoat couldn't be convinced. He kept on whining.
"Let's see," Good Fortune asked good-naturedly, pulling down Greencoat's trousers. "The skin is broken," he said, "but the bleeding will stop as soon as it swells. You're getting on fine and should stop your bellowing. Come, tea is ready."
Greencoat sat up groaning. He dragged himself the few steps to the fire and then threw himself down again.
"You have assaulted and injured me badly," he said in a feeble voice. "But wait a while. There's a day for fishing and a day for drying the nets."
"Is that your thanks for help in mortal danger?" asked Good Fortune furiously. "You should be saying thanks 10,000 times. In fact, a kowtow wouldn't be out of place."
"Shut your mouth," shouted Greencoat. "You could have removed the reptile with a shovel. Any child knows that."
"It was a poisonous viper, honored sir," said Christian. "It had been wakened from its winter sleep by the heat," Big Tiger explained. "Snakes are specially poisonous then."
"I was quite well," said Greencoat, "and now I'm seriously ill."
He drank tea, but would have no millet. Christian ran to the truck and fetched the honey cakes.
"Thanks," groaned Greencoat, with a mean glance at Good Fortune. Then he ate up a lot of the honey cakes.
"I can't sit up in front today," he said, "because of this crime that has been perpetrated on me."
Good Fortune glanced up, blew his tea, and said, "I know nothing about that." Then he finished his breakfast calmly and began to load the truck. Big Tiger brought along the shovel, Christian the cooking pot, and Good Fortune dragged the two thick branches, which he also loaded in. "They're for this evening," he said, "and there's room enough for Greencoat beside them. You two can sit with me in front."
When everything had been stowed away, Greencoat came limping over the stones. Again he said that a crime had been committed, but nobody answered him.
Big Tiger laid the two sleeping bags, one on top of the other, saying, "Here's a soft place for you. I hope you'll be comfortable."
"Good," groaned Greencoat.
Good Fortune helped him up, and he climbed in with a grimace of pain. Christian supported him behind, and Big Tiger, who was standing up on the truck, grasped him under the arm. When at last he was up, Big Tiger pushed a blanket under his head and another under the injured leg to raise it a little. He then hopped down from the truck. Good Fortune started up, and both boys sat down in the driver's cab in Greencoat's place.
"How was it about the cartridges?" asked Christian.
"At first," whispered Big Tiger, "he wanted to shoot Greencoat straight away. Then he thought to do it a little later on, and finally he postponed the great act of justice indefinitely."
He could not say more, for Good Fortune got in and drove off. The sky was calm and clear over the ravine of Durban Mott, which still lay in darkness, its edges sharply outlined in the morning light. But only Greencoat could see this. Big Tiger and Christian saw nothing but the sea of sand toward which Good Fortune steered slowly. Nowhere was an outlet to be seen. At first they drove along by the gravel basin until it ceased and there was only sand. They could see the caravan road a little distance off. Then it was no longer visible, for the sand became deeper and Good Fortune looked worried.
"There's no way out of this," he said. "We must drive through it until we get to the soda well."
The truck began to climb the low spur of the first dune. It bored its way through as well as it could, throwing up a lot of sand. Then it slid into the first of the furrows, which separated the arch-shaped dunes. There was firm ground once more. The caravan track became visible, and Good Fortune whistled contentedly. But after little more than 100 yards, the second spur came to obstruct the route, and the truck had hard going.
"These accursed Barkans," said Good Fortune peevishly.
"What are they?" asked Big Tiger.
"When the dunes form semicircles," Good Fortune explained, "instead of running straight, as proper dunes should, they are called Barkans." Christian looked up, but the sun was still hidden behind the rocks of Durban Mott. The dome of heaven arched steely gray in the hard light of morning, showing a little uncertain blue at the zenith. The dunes, too, were still colorless, but the further Good Fortune bored into their valleys, the higher they rose, and their curved spurs also grew higher. No longer did any firm ground break through. There was nothing anywhere but sand. The caravan road disappeared finally, and Good Fortune just had to drive on at random. He would have been quite content with this, and indeed would have thought nothing of driving blindly for a time if he could have made any headway, but he could not. The semicircular dunes, the spurs of which had joined, formed a barrier of sand to defy the most expert driver. The front wheels dug deep into the sand, the back wheels did the same, and Good Fortune shut off the motor.
"It can't be helped," said Big Tiger. "We're stuck like the fox in the ice."
"Come on, men," cried Good Fortune. "Take the shovels and planks. We must shift a big mountain." They set to work together, and the sand flew out on both sides. "Now," said Good Fortune, when the passage through had been half cleared, "a little more shoveling, and we shall be able to push the planks under the wheels. You boys shovel away, and I shall go on ahead and see whether we shall be able to cross the sand or shall have to turn back." A light morning breeze was sweeping clouds of sand from the ridges of the dunes. The sun was rising, the sky was turning a brilliant blue, and the sand was blowing from every barkan like yellow smoke. Good Fortune came back cheerful after half an hour's reconnoitering. "We must shovel a little more," he said, "and then we shall be rewarded for our perseverance."
"Hey," cried Greencoat from above,
Have you got stuck?
We're shoveling, Good Fortune replied, in order to drag your worthy person safely through the desert.
I've been the victim of a malicious assault.
We shall have more to say about that later on, retorted Good Fortune angrily.
All right, growled Greencoat, but he sounded more ill-humored than ever.
Good Fortune took no notice, but pushed two planks under the front wheels, thrust some of the branches under the rear wheels, and ordered Christian and Big Tiger to hold the rest of the planks ready and keep laying them down in front of the truck until they got to firm ground. Then Good Fortune started up the engine, and when it was running, he once more went around the truck to see that everything was in order. Then he got in satisfied and drove very slowly from plank to plank. Big Tiger and Christian had to run to carry the planks from the back to the front. It was desperately hard work. At last, Good Fortune shouted, "Enough!" and drove on to the next sand barrier, where the shoveling and plank carrying was repeated. The sun climbed over the dunes, and Greencoat complained that it was bothering him. But neither the boys nor Good Fortune made any reply. They were too busy shoveling and plank carrying. The whole forenoon passed in this way. At last, the crescents of the Barkans became lower, and Good Fortune said he thought they might put back the planks and shovels on the truck.
"Bolna!" cried Christian and Big Tiger joyfully, and in fact they had hardly driven a li when a plain opened out in the midst of the dunes, and even though it was covered with sand, Christian and Big Tiger shouted with joy at the great deliverance. Good Fortune had to laugh, but they could see he was just as delighted as they were at the wide panorama and the firm ground under the wheels. "Mountains and rivers are dangerous," said Good Fortune, "but sand is the most dangerous of all." They saw the caravan track again, too. It ran towards the middle of the plain, where sedges grew sparsely over a shimmering, whitish surface.
"Soda," said Good Fortune. "The water which gives you stomach ache is here." He pointed to a well which was surrounded by a low, firmly trodden rampart. Everywhere there were traces of caravans, little heaps of camel dung in neat rows, deserted campfires, many bleached bones, and quite a number of animal skeletons. The warm air streamed into the open side window of the truck, and it smelled of dust, dried dung, rotten water, ashes, and all the other glorious things which rejoice the wanderer when the midnight hour is past and the tents are pitched. Good Fortune sniffed devoutly. Suddenly he took his hand off the wheel and, waving it contemptuously, said, "These horseless cars are a foul invention. I'm ashamed to be driving in one of them." But after this self-accusation, he drove on calmly, and Christian could not fathom his silent thoughts. Shortly afterwards, he departed once more from the caravan track, which went on to the west, disappearing in the sea of sand. "We have to make a big detour," said Good Fortune, and steered resolutely northward at a great speed. Around the plain stood the high dunes and barkans, wave upon wave of them, but in the north their chains were interrupted, and he drove towards this break. By the time he reached the breach, the midday wind was sweeping over a great plateau bordered by dunes to the south and east. As far as the eye could reach westward, the ground was gravelly, with here and there a few tamarisks. They were only storm-stripped, rigid sticks with torn barks and barely showed above the ground. Around their roots lay the drifts of sand which the wind had sent whistling over the desert. After 2 hours' journey, the vista ceased to be bounded by dunes, and they got into a depression with an opening to the south.
"Why, yes," cried Good Fortune, "this is the road we want. Have you got your map, Compass Mountain?"
"It's up near Greencoat."
"That's a pity," said Good Fortune, "because you could mark in a well which we shall reach soon. It's called Chur Umpt. There we shall meet the caravan road again, and before long we shall arrive at the Lonely Tree, which is shown on the oldest maps. People say Genghis Khan slept in its shadow."
"And what comes after the Lonely Tree?" asked Christian.
"Then comes the mountain of which we've spoken, and if the spokes don't fall from the wheels, we shall stop the night there.
"Are you hungry?"
"Yes, we are hungry, honored sir."
"It can't be helped," said Good Fortune. "Rich people eat 3 times a day, but as we are not rich, we eat only 2x, so there's nothing before evening." They soon reached Chur Umpt Well, where the caravan road lay in the sun, waiting for Good Fortune to follow it to the lonely tree. But the route was bad. Again and again there were sandy belts, and it took more than 3 hours to cover the 40 li. The lonely tree stood at the foot of a hill. It was a black poplar with a thick trunk and a miserable wind-swept crown. The once mighty branches were ragged and broken. 20 paces off, there was a well which Good Fortune said was half sanded up because times had changed and the big caravans no longer used it. When Genghis Khan lived, it was quite different. In those days, the tree had leaves winter and summer, and the birds hopped through its branches and sang without ceasing. "There was a beautiful meadow here with rare flowers," he continued, "and it was a miracle in the midst of the desert. But these are unworthy days, and that is why everything is dried up and the birds have flown away. Look at the lonely tree," he continued, slowing down, "so that you can tell them about it when you go home." The 3 got out. "May we take a little twig as a keepsake?" asked Christian, respectfully.
"Nothing to stop you," said Good Fortune, and he lifted Christian onto his shoulders. Christian broke off 3 small twigs, and Good Fortune stuck 1 in his cap. Christian put the others away in the briefcase, which Greencoat handed down to him. He looked on the map for the lonely tree, but did not find it. "That map is absolutely useless," said Good Fortune emphatically.
"Perhaps it's only a matter of looking long enough," Christian suggested. "Yesterday I found Durban Mott, and there's a lot of sand here, and if we've gone first west and then north and then south, we must be here, and the place is called Ganzen Mott, and there's a well near."
"That's wonderful," cried Good Fortune, "and those who say a man should be sparing of his words are right. Ganzen Mott is the Mongolian for lonely tree, and I beg your pardon for my hasty speech."
"Pray don't mention it," said Christian, but he was very pleased. Christian now showed the compass to Good Fortune, who said approvingly that it was a very useful instrument, but he didn't know why it was necessary, since the sun shone in the day, and at night the Lord of the North sat on his throne. A note says that the Lord of the North is Shang-Ti, ruler of the cosmos, whose dwelling is on the polar star. So a compass in the long run only confirmed that the world went round just as it had always done, even though we live in unworthy days, he added with emphasis.
"But if the heavens are darkened by a storm," asked Big Tiger, "how do you manage then?"
"In that case, you remain where you are," Good Fortune explained. "In the desert, a storm blows up so much sand, and the sand thrashes about so terribly that the camels lie down, and even a horseless car cannot go on, because you can't see 10 paces ahead. You would fall into a ravine or a well, and the flying stones would smash the windows of the car. The only thing to do is to stop and cover up the motor so the sand doesn't get into it."
"But if it rains?" asked Christian.
Good Fortune laughed. "Mist and rain, hail, thunder, lightning, and dew are rare luxuries in the desert, and a man must submit to them. For that he needs no compass." Thereupon Christian put away the compass, and they talked about other things. And when the sun was already going down, a gray, elongated Table Mountain appeared in the distance. In front of it rose a fiery red mass, square and standing all alone. It was a tremendous size, though it towered but little over its surroundings. Good Fortune sounded the horn loud and then soft, and this meant, "Danger, look out."
"Bator was born here," whispered Christian. Big Tiger nodded.
As they came nearer, the road led downhill. A stony valley lay in a broad sweep around the gray Table Mountain and Mount Abder, and they could see the caravan road following the valley and coiling in the distance round a high plateau with a yellow shimmer. "There's sand again there," said Good Fortune, "but I've had enough of it for today." He drove the truck away from the caravan camping grounds onto the level open space on the bed of the valley opposite Mount Abder. Christian and Big Tiger observed it. 4 vertical, deeply riven red walls
rose steeply from the windswept sand. "It really does look like a box," thought Christian, but he did not dare to say it. Good Fortune was more bustling than ever, and when one job was done, he ordered the next, filling the tank, pumping up the tires, making the fire. He was obviously afraid one of them might utter a thoughtless word about Abder, the box. Greencoat only came down from the truck for his meal. He was still limping and remained silent, apart from announcing that he wished to sleep on the truck so that another innocent snake would not get killed. Christian and Big Tiger willingly fetched their sleeping bags and left Greencoat their two fur coats. Good Fortune pulled up some dry tamarisks and lit a fire. Then he threw on top of it the branches he had brought from Durban Mott, raked out the embers, and shoveled sand over them, as the evening before. By this time night had fallen. The box stood silent in the silvery moonlight, and Christian and Big Tiger lay down beside Good Fortune on the warm sand. The truck stood a good distance away, and so deep was the silence that they could hear Greencoat snoring. Probably 2 or 3 hours had passed when Christian was awakened by the sound of hoofs, and raising his head he saw, a few paces away, a row of dark animals laden with little boxes. They were not camels, that he could see at once, but neither were they horses. At this moment Big Tiger woke up. Right next to him a man leapt from the saddle and stood, a black silhouette beside his dark mount. He wore a uniform like Good Fortune's, and the big animal, which looked like a horse, had long ears, so it was a mule. Good Fortune still slept on. "Hey," cried the soldier, tapping his padded trousers with his riding whip, "I want to say how pleased I am to see you." In a trice, Good Fortune was on his feet. He looked over at the passing caravan of mules, and then at the soldier. "Am I disturbing you?" asked the soldier. "I'm sorry to break your rest." "A man's sleep is sacred," replied Good Fortune uncivilly. Had he not noticed that the other man also wore a pistol in his belt, he would probably have said, "Scoundrel," or, "I hear a lout speaking." "One should not break old friendship," said the soldier, smiling. "Neither should one be quarrelsome." Saying this, he bowed and... "Oh, long life," cried Good Fortune. "I thought you were gathered to your fathers." "I have escaped the sword," said Long Life simply, and they bowed very low and very joyfully to each other. "How is it that you come riding this way?" asked Good Fortune. "How is it that you come driving this way?" asked Long Life. "It's good to meet," said Good Fortune. "Let us sit down and tell each other what is worth telling." "I've nothing worth mentioning to relate," answered Long Life modestly. Meanwhile, the mules had passed by one after the other. There were several soldiers with them, and one of them came up and wanted to dismount too, but Long Life shouted sternly, "Ride on! I'll follow you later. Wait for me at Chur Umt." The soldier rode on obediently, and the quick clatter of hoofs faded away in the night. "I see you've been promoted," said Good Fortune, "and I congratulate you." "The little star is of no value," replied Long Life. He took a leather strap from his pocket and hobbled the mule's forelegs. "It's warm here," said Good Fortune. "Let us lie on our stomachs and chat in comfort. It's many a day since I heard your voice." "I've yearned for your company," replied Long Life. "A man who lives far from his native place rejoices when he meets a fellow townsman. Who are those two there?" "Forgive me," said Good Fortune. "I forgot to tell you that these young princes are Compass Mountain and Big Tiger. You can tell me all your news without hesitation. We both know enough about old times. You need not touch on them." "Will you please begin?" requested Long Life. "How could I dare?" cried Good Fortune. "It is for you to speak first." Long Life was silent for a while, and so deep was the silence all round that Greencoat's snores resounded like a two-handled saw, and Long Life asked, "Is there somebody else there?" "There is somebody else, and you know him," said Good Fortune. "It's the Honorable Merchant." "Shong Ma is with you?" cried Long Life, horrified. "I heard he was dead." "Hush," said Good Fortune, and it was plain that the turn of the conversation embarrassed him. Christian and Big Tiger nudged each other. "Shong Ma is dead," said Good Fortune in a low voice, "but a certain Mr. Greencoat has taken his place."
"I've heard of him," said Long Life. "He carries on a lively trade. He's grown a long beard, and nobody can recognize him."
"Then the venerable chief will seek him in vain," said Long Life, reassured.
Good Fortune shrugged his shoulders. "That was none of his business," he said. "It was the business of the venerable chief, and would Long Life please go on with his news?"
"As you wish," began Long Life. "I was sorry when I heard you had become a soldier. I didn't want to be a soldier after the unfortunate events you know of, so I returned to Liwan Pei at Hami."
"How dare you hang your black face over my counter?" shouted Li. "You have been incautious, therefore bear your misfortune yourself."
"So I left and became a soldier.
First, I was in the garrison of Sining Fu, and later at Suzhou. For 6 years, all went well, until the general in Hami got the fatal idea of making war on the venerable chief."
"I heard you didn't win the war," said Good Fortune.
"The venerable chief slaughtered us like lambs in spring," Long Life confessed.
"How was that?" asked Good Fortune sympathetically.
"We were 1,000 strong," said Long Life, "and we had everything necessary to win a war. We had even the latest automatic rifles and small portable machine guns, which we carried on camels. Then we set out to march through the desert of stone and the sea of sand. When we arrived in front of the venerable chief's castle, after a month, we started shooting right away to show him what was up. He understood at once and shut the gates. He had only 300 horsemen, but we were 1,000. There he was caught in a trap, and our general said, 'We need not hurry.' We were glad of that. 'When the bandits have nothing more to eat,' said our general, 'and have used all their fodder beans, they will come out. Then we shall shoot the venerable chief and his 300 men, too.' So we made a deep trench around the castle, did a bit of shooting every day, and waited. The autumn passed by, and the weather got cold, and we froze miserably, especially at night. 'It doesn't matter,' said the general. He thought he had got up early, but he met people who hadn't slept at all. For when another night had passed, and some of us lay there frozen, a mighty outburst of thunder and lightning rent the dawn. We thought the end of the world had come. Heaven and earth mingled in confusion, and the wall of the castle burst in several places and fell down. Then most of us imagined we had won, and we set up a great shout. But out of the breaches came the venerable chief's 300 horsemen, with nothing but their swords in their hands. The venerable chief himself was among them, and the barbarians were roaring like tigers. But we could not shoot them because of our frozen fingers, and our rifles and guns were frozen too, especially the automatic ones. So row after row of us were devoured by the sword. The bandits galloped through our trenches, and their horses stamped in blood. I ran to the few horses we had, for I saw the war was lost, and so I escaped with 4 others. But it was a retreat, neither voluntary, friendly, nor merry, for the enemy pursued us. Luckily, we met a caravan which gave us beans for the horses. When we reached the Gashan Nor after 10 days, we were half dead. It was night, and we made a big fire of tamarisk. We shouldn't have done that, for suddenly we heard the clatter of hoofs and the tiger roar of 2 barbarians. I leaped into the darkness and fired many shots. One of the fellows fell from his horse, and the other was thrown off too, for his horse took fright. We fell on him with sticks and swords, and I split his forehead open. There he lay, and I said, 'This dog and this son of a tortoise has met his deserts.' The firelight shone on his face, and suddenly I recognized moonlight. The same moonlight who had once spared the lives of us 2. My comrades wanted to strip him of all he had, but I said, 'Leave him. I will not permit it.' Then we rode on, as the place was no longer safe for us."
"Did you kill Moonlight quite dead, or only half?" asked Good Fortune.
"As dead as a corpse can be," Long Life assured him. "That corpse," said Good Fortune, "goes wolf hunting again. It must have been a very quick rebirth."
"How is that?" asked Long Life. "I'm lying here, and Moonlight's bones are lying by the Gashan Nor, and are white from the winter's snows."
No, replied Good Fortune, it's not as you say. I saw Moonlight 3 days ago. He was merry and full of goodwill, and we made a pact of mutual friendship. He had a red sword scar from one temple to the other, but otherwise he was sound. When I met him, he was in the act of killing a wolf with the lead bag.
The order of the world must be disturbed, cried Long Life. The dead rise up and ride and hunt.
We live in queer times, said Good Fortune, and such things may happen, but I advise you to avoid meeting Moonlight. As far as I can see, he's being met at Sunit by a man named Thunderbolt. He's probably already on his way to the Venerable Chief, and you may meet the two red birds in Cow Pond, or even in the Valley of Dark Rushing Water. They are changing horses on the way. It seems to be a very urgent matter. I'm not afraid of Moonlight, said Long Life. Have you got a picked band of heroes with you? No, but we're carrying precious goods on trust. That gives even a coward courage. How many cases? 60. Each case is worth gold, since opium has become so dear. Where are you taking the stuff to? Asked Good Fortune contemptuously. We're to deliver it in Kuei Hua. More than that, I do not know. I'm not you, said Good Fortune. Do as you think right. I shall follow your advice, said Long Life. We will turn aside at Shur Amt and get on to the southern road near the Monastery of the Rich Springs. There are two kinds of courage, said Good Fortune. My heart rejoices that you choose the thoughtful kind. Experience has been my teacher, remarked Long Life, smiling. But I'm still in the dark about you. It's now your turn to speak. Then Good Fortune told how he had become a soldier of General Fang. But you know, he said, that was not what I wanted. I wanted to earn money to send to my old mother. One day our company was asked whether any of us could drive a horseless car. I stepped forward at once, and 10 others did the same. Good-for-nothing louts, most of them, who had never seen an automobile in their lives. But no more had I. A strange officer came and asked us about things of which we didn't even know the names. Then he realized that we were not motor drivers at all. When he came to me, he asked me what I would do if the radiator steamed. I said, where there's great heat, water is the thing. This answer pleased him, and he took me to Hunan. I got a new uniform, for now I belonged to General Wu's army. The officer no doubt knew I couldn't drive a car, so he took me in hand for a week. When I could drive, he presented me to the general. Here's the man, he said, for whom I have been searching zealously. He's General Fang's best driver, and the general has only consented to release him to oblige your excellency. Then he ordered me to drive backward and forward, and when General Wu saw I could do it, he made me his chauffeur. In no time, I learned everything without ever letting him see how little I had known in the beginning. When the war with Cheng Tso-ling broke out 3 years later, I was able to take an automobile to pieces and put it together again. The general gave me a better wage, and I sent it to Suzhou. I heard that, said Long Life, when I came home from the war against the Venerable Chief. Your mother was telling everywhere that you had become a great gentleman and didn't forget your mother, and everyone was congratulating her on her worthy son. At home in Suzhou, you've got a big face. No one would be surprised if one day you bought your mother a palace with 10 men servants and 20 maids. I haven't got that far yet, said Good Fortune gravely. At this, Big Tiger gave Christian a nudge, and they both thought of what they had heard in White Stone under the Kong. I've rested enough now, said Long Life, and I must go and catch up on my men. Where are you traveling to now? I'm driving to Xinqiang, said Good Fortune, standing up. How will you manage that, asked Long Life, without falling into the hands of the Venerable Chief? I've been thinking of that. As you have lost the war against him, I can't go straight through the desert. Is there still gasoline in Olontor? There is, but there's a military guard there. That doesn't worry me. I've an order from General Wu for the gasoline. Then I'll drive to Suzhou, and from there by the Silk Road to Hami. All the same, you must be very careful, Long Life advised. Since the Venerable Chief captured our modern arms, he's operating on the Silk Road, too.
From Anxi to Tsing Tsing Cha, it is no longer safe. The venerable chief is as swift as a spirit."
"Thank you for your information," said Good Fortune, and he took Long Life aside and whispered a few words to him.
Long Life then went to his saddlebag and gave Good Fortune a small package.
"These will be sufficient," he said. "Take care nobody sees who's with you," he whispered as he mounted. "It might cost you all your lives."
"No fear," Good Fortune replied in a low voice to "You yourself would never recognize the honorable merchant."
"Anyone as cocksure as you are," said Long Life, "should be able to get through anywhere. Goodbye, and may you have lucky stars for the whole of your journey."
Good Fortune bowed, and Christian and Big Tiger stood up and bowed too. They looked after Long Life as he rode off. When the quick beat of the mule's hoofs had died away, Big Tiger said,
"Permit me to ask, who is the venerable chief?"
"Oh, men," cried Good Fortune, "the venerable chief should not be named by name any more than this mountain. I'm standing here, and the venerable chief knows it. Now I lie down, and he hears it. He is a man who fled into the wilderness, where even a tamarisk cannot take root, and there his stronghold stands. He is the greatest robber within the four seas, and a murderer, too. All the caravans which pass through the Sea of Sand have to pay him tribute. None can resist him, for success is on his side, and failure is the lot of his enemies. The Mongols say he is a demigod, but he is a cruel devil."
"What's his name?" asked Big Tiger softly.
"His name is Dampignac," whispered Good Fortune.